We're here to talk about treatment-resistant depression. You heard enough about depression in the last few days? So in studying the agenda, and I have been here studying, right? I've been here walking among you ever since Wednesday. I don't know how many people noticed. I noticed that there has been kind of a crescendo building with all of this talk about depression, right? Every talk is diagnostics, what's new, what are new ways to look at it? And it's building more and more and more. And basically, all of my wonderful colleagues have filled the bases and given me a fantastic opportunity to be here at the plate with all of you to hit big home run, because now we're going to talk about what to do. Learning objectives, right? So we're here to recognize clinical presentation, diagnostic criteria for treatment-resistant depression, evaluate the safety, efficacy of pharmacotherapies, right? This is the what to do part. So we're going to move by that in a step-by-step basis. Develop effective evidence-based treatment plan for patients with TRD, and think about adjusting patient medication to improve treatment responses and remissions so that we can get that outcome that we all dream about. So number one, almost every single day, patients say to me, hey, Dr. Sauve, actually they usually call me Will because I encourage them to call me Will. I've been a doctor for a long time. I basically never forget. So, hey, Will, is my depression caused by low serotonin, or does it have something to do with not enough dopamine because I feel like I need more dopamine, or is it my situation, or is something the matter with my brain? And I look at them and I say, yes. All of these things are possibly true, and that's the take home from this that you have been hearing about now for the past several days, right? Complex, multifactorial. So I was a little bit of a surprise to me when there was that article, can't remember what paper, a couple months ago, where they exposed that they're like, depression is not caused by low serotonin. And I'm like, who thought it was? Like, I wasn't taught that in residency, and that was like a number of years ago, and believed that for a long time. So all of these are possible. All of them are kind of possible at the same time. I want you to pay special attention, not for today, but just for the future, to this cellular metabolic hypothesis. Interesting stuff about mitochondrial function coming down the pike that is tied in with inflammation and things like that. So things are going to get really interesting, I'm going to say, in the next year. So ask me again then. Definitions. What is treatment-resistant depression? Right? That was one of the learning objectives. The joke's on you. There is no definition. Oh, thank heavens that's not one of the post-test questions, right? So this is not really something that has established criteria. There isn't like a DSM-5-TR treatment-resistant depression diagnosis. So when you read about it, it's a little all over the map. You know, there are some things that are FDA approved for treatment-resistant depression, and that's considered appropriate after one drug trial. Right? Then other places might say two drug trials, a little bit of argument over whether it needs to be two different classes, right? The European Medication Agency says they could be the same, but not everybody thinks that. It's not so easy to judge the prevalence when the definition isn't super clear. Like Dr. Schwartz, I think the Rush criteria is not kind of a bad place to think about it, but like him, right, I would add a lot of cooler new stuff in between like SSRIs, SNRIs, and tricyclics and MAOIs and ECT. So we got lots to think about in terms of options. More definitions. So this is what qualifies as a response. I imagine a lot of us know that. So we have depression, and then we start treatment. It doesn't have to be medication treatment, by the way. 50% improvement is generally sort of that minimum for partial victory. You get a response no matter what treatment you do. So then what about remission? Start a treatment, again, any treatment, not just a medication treatment, and get 100% better, which would mean symptom-free, right? Like better from depression is not the same thing as happy, but we can be symptom-free and the illness has resolved. Remission, if by definition goes on for more than a couple few months, we can start calling it recovery. And people can be considered in recovery or even recovered as this goes on, potentially up to years. So again, you know, what's holding us back from that? And remission is the resolution of all symptoms. That's what we want, but we only really get a third of patients into remission with that first try. Right? Once again, only in baseball and psychiatry is a 300 batting average considered good. But that's where we are, and for 60 years, it's kind of all we've had. Some of these reasons why we don't get remission, well, residual symptoms, well, that's by definition, that's not remission, right? Because we got, you know, somewhere between 50 and 90% better, but we have residual symptoms. So response, not remission. Difficulty tolerating medications is going to make it hard to reach remission because the patients don't want to take the pills. Even if they're working, they don't like it. There's also a little bit of a weight, right? So there's a lot of faith involved when I say take this pill and it's going to take some time, potentially weeks, before you start to notice that it's making things any better. And speaking of the world being grossly unfair, does it take weeks for the side effects to kick in? No. Right? So you're going to feel the side effects and you're just going to have to believe me that it's going to be worth it. So hard to inspire that kind of trust, especially on a first visit. There are novel, rapidly efficacious. You've heard all about this, and we're going to go over them a little bit more. So that might change a little bit. And then once again, depression's a lot of things. So that also sometimes can make it difficult to get the results you want on the first try. More definitions, relapse versus recurrence. And so the difference here, a relapse to depression is when you either got a response or a remission. That remission did not last for that DSM-5-TR criteria of like 2-ish to 3-ish months or more before a new episode would be called a recurrence. So relapse is when you had strep, you didn't finish all your antibiotics. You know you did that. Now the strep's back and it's mad, right? I like to think of it that way with depression. Relapse happened either because treatment was stopped, maybe because the patient was feeling better, or sometimes you can't really explain it, it just gets worse again, and maybe we didn't have a true remission. But if you can get into that 2 to 3 to 4 months of remission and then a recovery period that could potentially last years and a new episode comes up, we call that a recurrence. Right, let's say that again. So when someone is recovered and the depression comes back, we would call that a recurrence. Get it? Okay. So how many people do remit? Well, this is kind of like an upside down version of STAR-D. So we get a 33% success rate on that first treatment. If that is not successful, we do another treatment. Another 20% can be picked up. Third treatment, 6 to 7% get picked up. Fourth treatment, maybe another 6 to 7%. So we, if you're really aggressive enough, and I mean be aggressive, you know, we can get 67, almost 70% of people towards remission if you can get 4 treatments, particularly if it's being done in a rational fashion. That still leaves us with 33% of people that are not remitting after 4 treatments. STAR-D also kind of suggested that medications are not going to be particularly successful after that. So it's also important maybe to think about escalating in other ways. And remission is thought, at least statistically, to be protective. So take home point from this and why it's so important to try to get remission, right, and get remission as fast as we can. If you can get remission after 1 treatment, we can see relapses and recurrences only about 33-ish percent at the 12-month mark, whereas if they had residual symptoms, it's not nearly as optimistic. And then, you know, 2 treatments is kind of less good, 3 treatments, it's less good. And after 4 treatments, that benefit kind of disappears, which is sort of interesting. It also is a little bit despair-inducing because, honestly, I don't know that you can control how many treatments it takes to get to remission. So let's not try to be too hopeless about that. But I'll go back to the part where it's important to be aggressive, be fast, and try to move into that remission using all the tools in your toolbox as fast as you can. So what would be the most common residual symptoms to look for? The most common residual symptoms are insomnia, fatigue, pain, concentration, interest. So this patient's at least 50% better. They've had a response. We declared a solid 2 base hit. Right? They're better than they were. You deserve a small pat on the back, but we got these residual symptoms. Once again, to call back to Dr. Schwartz, how are you ever going to catch that if we're not doing screening, right? Which could be scales and which could be Sigi caps, and I'm not going to try to say it the way Dr. Schwartz does because only Schwartz can Schwartz, right? But some sort of screening, because here's what happens in the 15-minute medication check visit. First of all, it's a 7-minute visit, right? Because I have 7 minutes to talk to my patient, I have about 5 minutes to curse at the EMR, and then about 2 minutes to cry softly to myself and then move on, you know, to the next patient. So I got 7 minutes. Mrs. Smith, how's it been going with that SSRI? And she says, fine. I'm like, great, let's move on and do all the other check boxes because I don't have time to try to be like, are you fine? And go into that whole thing. So doing some kind of screening helps me get out of that, helps me remember it's been 8 weeks. No, she is not fine. It's not gonna occur to Mrs. Smith to ask for more. She doesn't know what more is, right? My average person that comes to me has had depression for 30 years. They've had 8 drug trials. They don't know what to ask for. I tell them they could get into remission. They're like, what's that? I'm like, well, you'll see. And we move on and we'll have fun together. So screening, screening, screening. I think it's the only way you're going to reliably catch this. It's the only way I'm going to reliably catch it. Now, when we talk about time course, take home from this, what more proof do you need that depression is not a serotonin deficiency? Right? Again, why I found that newspaper article like a little jarring and kind of amusing that people thought that still. When you start a typical reuptake inhibitor, that serotonin, that norepinephrine, that dopamine is moving up almost immediately, and we tend not to see any kind of clinical effects. Right? If all you needed was more serotonin, you'd feel better like right away. And these would be miraculous pills. It is interesting that the clinical effect kind of typically coincides, right, with the downregulation of the receptors. Remember though, right, we've been taught many, many times, that doesn't mean that's the thing that gets people better, but they do tend to kind of go together. So maybe this chronic exposure to elevated serotonin, once the brain starts adapting to that, that might kind of coincide with clinical benefit. So what to do, what to do, what to do? Well, we'll start with the pharmacology, right? Augmenting strategies, serotonin, dopamine blockers, ketamine, esketamine. You've been hearing about that, and that's a mainstream option now, depending on, there's probably some geographical availability. Lithium, buspirone, thyroid hormones, triple action, right? So opportunities to not just go after serotonin, not just go after the dopamine, go after all three, and don't give that depression anywhere to hide. SNRIs plus mirtazapine, lovingly known as California rocket fuel. SSRI plus an SNRI, maybe a stimulant, or we might add these things to modafinil. All interesting possibilities. So the first of these serotonin dopamine blockers that kind of came into the forefront for this use was good old olanzapine, right? And Dr. Stahl has cautioned us for many years to try to not call these things antipsychotics because they sort of do all the things. Quite a few years ago, maybe when I was considerably younger, it was Dr. Stahl that said on the stage in my general direction, because I hadn't met him yet, it was such a sad time. We should probably be calling these broad-spectrum psychotropics, and I never forgot that, and I love that. So let's try to kind of start that trend. So we have 5-HT2A and olanzapine, 5-HT2C, alpha-2C, and then combine that fluoxetine, right? That's a well-known combination, olanzapine plus fluoxetine. And you can start to see these multiple receptor actions that we can be attacking depression in that way. Downsides, right? Weight metabolic problems at least, you know, 2 or 3 of the receptors that we're hitting here. So obviously we want to be mindful of that. Quetiapine, right, also fairly accepted when it comes to augmenting for depression, and it's got 5-HT1A, 5-HT2A, 5-HT2C, 5-HT7, right, which has been interesting the last couple of years, and alpha-2A and NET, right? So this is a very interesting drug for depression, but it's got those same liabilities, and it's famous for that. And fun fact that we might already know, weight metabolic risk with quetiapine is not dose-dependent. So this goes back to when I was a resident, my attending used to say to me, if you're gonna use it, use it, right? This drug is not safer at lower doses. So there's literally no reason to be ginger, right? Get to the dose that's gonna be helpful. And if we can get the patient better without too much of this risk, then we'll all be happier for it. Aripiprazole. Aripiprazole's FDA approved for this use. Right, remember, so it's been approved for augmentation for quite a few years, and that can be related to 5-HT2C, 5-HT7, alpha-2A, and D3. The D2 action of aripiprazole is partial agonism, and it's probably no accident that aripiprazole is approved for augmentation of depression at the 5 to 10 milligram dosing range, where it is, in fact, dopaminergic. because of that partial agonism property. It is a pet peeve of mine, the number of people that come to me on 20 milligrams of aripiprazole, and I ask them, why was that put on their list? And they said, for my depression, because 5 milligrams didn't work. Once you cross 15 milligrams, aripiprazole starts doing the opposite, right? And it becomes that net dopamine blockade, and that might not be your friend in a depressed patient. So let's be mindful. Brexpiprazole, right? It's similar, 5-HT2A, 5-HT1A, alpha-2C. It's got that D2 partial agonism, so it may also be thought of to be used in this way. It also has a property of the alpha-1A antagonist receptor, which, if you look at this fun little cartoon here, is disinhibiting via the VTA dopaminergic action in the prefrontal cortex. So it may have a somewhat unique antidepressant property for that reason. So another fun thing you potentially add on, and then no party is complete without cariprazine. And cariprazine is being looked at in this way. We have potential 5-HT2A, 5-HT1A, alpha-2A, alpha-1A. Also D3 is maybe being thought of as having its own special antidepressant properties when it comes to using cariprazine as an augmentation drug in the context of depression. And now for something completely different, right? Ketamine. So you've already kind of gotten the skinny from Dr. Cutler on ketamine, so we won't, you know, get too far into the weeds, beating that horse even further into the ground. But what you're looking at here, right, you see the little mirror, right? Mirror images. So what's actually in this picture is S-ketamine and R-ketamine, right, the left and the right hand enantiomers, respectively. When you put them together, you get good old-fashioned 1966 racemic ketamine, right, approved as a wonderful anesthetic that's been used in particular applications for years and years and years, started looking good for depression about 20 years ago. And then the reason why the S-ketamine is pertinent is because that is actually the FDA-approved for depression version of ketamine. And the quick review of how this is supposed to work for us, right? Ketamine, anti-NMDA receptor, and by blocking that receptor, we actually end up disinhibiting glutamate release from the upstream NMDA antagonism. It's robust enough, they call it a burst, right, of that glutamate release. And that burst of release is going to not do much to an NMDA receptor that's been blocked by ketamine, but it's going to have a lot of action on the AMPA receptor. And there's the ERK and the AKT and the famous mTOR, right? Are all the cool kids talking about mTOR? They will be. So don't forget about mTOR. And mTOR, neuroplasticity. That's kind of what we're looking here. And then a second action is the calcium channel, and we see release of BDNF, right? Neuroplasticity, neurogenesis, all those good things the brain can do, VEGF, unpronounceable things, yada, 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 dendritic spine formation. So that's what we can get out of ketamine, S-ketamine. Why S-ketamine? Right, S-ketamine may be more potent against the receptor, so S-ketamine might be one of the reasons why this was able to be useful as a nasally inhaled formulation, as opposed to having to stick to that, you know, only IV infusion. And that's all about bioavailability, right? So oral ketamine, about 10% bioavailable. Right, IV ketamine, 100% bioavailable by definition. It's glorious. You can just dose it by milligrams per kilogram. Super predictable. Intranasal, about 30-ish to 50-ish percent bioavailable. Like, you'll be a little more vague. 30 to 50%, that makes it a little bit unpredictable. I can tell you, those of you who might have experience with S-ketamine so far might know this too. My patients quite commonly tell me that they have a different treatment experience, sometimes day to day. And so I talk to them about bioavailability, and their eyes start to glaze over because I'm a giant nerd and they don't really want to hear it. And I'm like, just think of it this way. When you're using something with that broad of a bioavailability, the actual experience, kind of strength of the dose, can literally be affected by the number of boogies in your nose. And they go, oh! And, you know, we can modulate that a little bit by doing the things you do, right? Working on the spray technique and trying to get your nose clear. But there's only so much you can do to change that. But otherwise, great option, FDA approved. Speaking of NDMA, thank you very much, we have dextromethorphan, and you've already kind of heard all about that. So when you can potentiate dextromethorphan and stop it from metabolizing into dextrorphan, then we can get some of that NMDA action. We also see CERT, we also see sigma. There's more than one way to potentiate dextromethorphan. The recently, 30 seconds ago, FDA-approved way to do it is to do it with bupropion. And then, you know, it's probably no accident that you also have DAT and NET, you know, with your bupropion while it's potentiating the dextromethorphan. And that is FDA-approved for depression. Right, not treatment-resistant depression in particular, but don't overthink it, right? It is FDA-approved for depression, which means it's another novel treatment while you're working through trying to get those patients to remission. You can also potentiate with quinidine, right? That's been FDA-approved for pseudobulbar affect for quite a few years, right? A low dose, like 10 milligrams of quinidine plus dextromethorphan, same thing. It helps you kind of take advantage of that dextromethorphan pharmacology. Are there other ways that you could potentiate good old dextromethorphan if you like read carefully and you know how to work on 2D6? Yes. If you do that, are you gonna get entirely predictable results? Probably not. And so, but I mean, who wants predictability all the time? I don't know. Other augmentation strategies, lithium. Lithium probably still doesn't get enough attention. I've been under the impression it's been getting some play the last few years for not just for bipolar disorder, but also for depression. You see people using lower doses. One kind of elegant thing about lithium, very, very, very short list of psychopharmacologic agents that actually have data on reducing the outcome of suicide. You know, so for what it's worth, it's always kind of an interesting choice. Low doses, dosed once a day, you'd have to live to 130 years old for this to do something bad to your kidneys, right? So it's going to be a pretty safe option. Me personally, I'd still get levels because I don't think you could justify not doing it. But when you're dosing in these low dosing ranges, you're not going to get levels that would scare you. So it's, you know, more just for validation. Buspirone, right? And I heard Dr. Stahl allude to that, that serotonergic action of buspirone combined with other antidepressant agents can be useful. And thyroid hormones can be interesting. A, sometimes depression is at least in part manifested by hypothyroidism. I mean, so if you're using thyroid hormones and you're addressing a hypothyroidism, winner, like that's clearly an elegant solution. But they're also being used just purely as augmentation for depression, and it's something worth thinking about. Then we have our triple action combos. So here what you see is a vanilla combination of SSRI and DRI. So when we put those things together, you're basically blocking the reuptake of serotonin, of norepinephrine, of dopamine, all kind of equally what you might call a single boost. Then we get a little more exciting and we mix an SNRI with an NDRI. And we're doing the same thing, but we're kind of getting that double hit on the noradrenergic side, so that might be a little bit more robust when you're wanting to get more aggressive with these patients. How many times have I said aggressive so far? I'm aggressive about aggression. California Rocket Fuel, right? Now that's an aggressive name, right? So that we know that the implication here is this is very robust. So what we're doing is we're combining an SNRI, which is giving us blockade of reuptake at serotonin and norepinephrine, right? That's one part of California Rocket Fuel. The second part of California Rocket Fuel is disinhibiting release of all of the monoamines by the alpha-2 antagonism. And what we get is a very, very robust kind of quadruple double boost. So once again, reuptake blockade at serotonin and norepinephrine plus disinhibition of all of the monoamines by that alpha-adrenergic blockade. Arousal combos, right? Because you wouldn't want to call them anything but arousal when you're using a stimulant. Once again, right? Adding an SNRI, you're getting the CERT, you're getting the NET. But then by putting a stimulant in there, you actually have action against the dopamine receptor, also against the norepinephrine receptor. Just in case this picture is just a tiny bit confusing, right? I know it says NDRI against that DAT receptor, and I don't see any bupropion in here anywhere. The point of this is meant to imply that when you are mixing these agents, you're kind of effectively getting that NDRI action by being able to block serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine and kind of getting a double hit on the norepinephrine side. I know that was a little bit abstract, but you can do it. SNRIs plus modafinil, again, single, 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 but modafinil is getting you that dopaminergic push and maybe helping someone stay awake, because that's kind of what it's for, while getting your SNRI action, so it's also potentially a useful combination. So then, right, when I alluded kind of back to those like rush criteria, we can think about switching to some more aggressive drugs that people have kind of been reluctant to use over the years. And that can include tricyclic antidepressants, monoamine oxidase inhibitors. Does it seem late in the game to be bringing up psychotherapy? Like, why do we wait? Like, how many trials have we done now? Like 9, right? As we're kind of talking through this. And no, we're not, but I'll get to a little bit more about that later. The one thing I would suggest, because yes, I would advocate for bringing up psychotherapy early. I earn my chops in the inpatient setting, right? I've spent the majority of my career seeing people who are severely depressed, always at least a little bit, if not a lot, cognitively impaired. Generally, in my practice, those patients have to be made well enough to be able to participate in psychotherapy. Well, it's like, I wouldn't necessarily go there right away, because honestly, a lot of my patients don't have cognition for it, and it's kind of mean to make them try to do that when they're not going to be able to retain things and they're just going to be overwhelmed. And then TMS is something to think about, more about that in a minute. So the tricyclics are good old friends. What you get from this is that they have a lot of receptor actions, right? Sodium channel blocker, SERT, NET, M1, and these are, of course, you know, pre-fluoxetine, pre-SRIs, and back in the 70s, this is kind of what you had in addition to MAOIs. These drugs are still available. I mean, we can get a few of them. And the truth of the matter is they traditionally work great, right? So used to love to torment my residents. I'd tell them, there was a great hosanna when fluoxetine hit the market, right? Does it work better than the TCAs? And they all go, ah. And I'm like, no, it doesn't, right? It's not more efficacious. TCAs are typically thought of as highly efficacious. They're also kind of hard to tolerate, right? Get somebody on a really big dose and then you say, are you less depressed? They're like, I don't know, I'm never awake. Just kind of sleep all day, and all sorts of other dry mouth and the stuff that people complained about. So they're difficult to tolerate. People don't like them. So that's one reason why we don't reach for them right away. The other reason is because in overdose, they are scary as heck, right? So we have a severely depressed patient, maybe chronic suicidal ideations, at least passive, and about a week's worth of tricyclic antidepressant in overdose can kill you deader than a doornail. Right, and that sodium channel blockade can potentially be coma and seizures. Sodium channel blockade is an arrhythmia, right, specifically called torsade de pointes, and death, which can happen very, very quickly. It doesn't mean never use these drugs. It does mean, like, think hard about the safety of your patient and how good they're going to be at following instructions. And speaking of following instructions, right, we kind of don't always like to reach for monoamine oxidase inhibitors either, because if we don't feel we can trust our patients to follow the diet, then we feel these drugs are very dangerous, because once you get this robust action by blocking both monoamine A and B, you can also have hypertensive crises, right? If the patients are eating too much tyramine, red wine, fava beans, you know, all of our favorites, and they might stroke out. And we do tend to get a little bit worried about that. So again, it's the reliability of your patient, whether or not they're going to follow instructions and be safe with these drugs. But then you can get some really good efficacy, you know, if you think you can safely move in that direction. Back to the psychotherapy thing, the take-home point from this was that there's at least one study out there that suggests that psychotherapy is not better than treatment as usual medications. The medications are not better than psychotherapy, but it was suggested that when the two are purposely combined, mindfully, you might get a better result. I just heard last night that there's another newer study that kind of said the opposite of that, so your mileage may vary. But what I would go back to is, patient maybe got at least a partial response. You clinically can be the judge. Are they feeling well enough to participate in a meaningful way? And then I think you can really get something done with psychotherapy. ECT, it was wonderful to hear Dr. Cutler give a little shout out for ECT. One question I have for you though, like ECT is the king, right? Undefeated in 8+ decades, best treatment there is for the treatment of depression. How many of you in this room have a reliable pipeline to refer a patient to ECT where you're confident that it's practiced correctly and the patient's going to be able to get there in a timely fashion? More than I thought, but not many, So this is, yes, best treatment there is. I really, really, really wish it was utilized more in this country and used sooner in the course. But I also totally get that probably for most of us, me included, I don't have a particularly good pipeline. I know like one guy to call and I still don't really know how we'd get people in a timely fashion. So this is very difficult when you're in the trenches to get for people. VNS, kind of been trying to make a comeback. So this can be highly efficacious, but it is an operating room procedure to get it done. DBS is investigational. Transcranial magnetic stimulation is, right, FDA approved since 2008. Quite mainstream, actually not that hard to come by. Right? Just about every commercial insurance and all the big players cover this. So definitely be thinking about that. TMS is a neurophysiological technique that allows a non-invasive stimulation of the brain. Right? We are literally using a 1.5 Tesla magnet to induce current and electrically stimulate the brain. The patients will not feel anything that reminds them of electricity. I've had more than one person who was kind of disappointed by that fact. You know, they come in, they're hoping for a show. I'm like, sorry, we can put it on HDTV for you. You know, it's like, we don't want you to get too bored. The point of this treatment is kind of twofold, right? One hypothesized mechanism is that we stimulate in that prefrontal cortex and we're releasing kind of all the monoamines in the prefrontal cortex, not the occipital cortex, that'd be weird. But in the prefrontal cortex, we're releasing monoamines in there. Item number two, and this is my favorite, we're stimulating a whole circuit, right, that starts with the DMPFC, well, the DLPFC, but now in newer stuff, the DMPFC. And then that actually goes through the whole frontoparietal network, the VMPFC, some of the deeper structures. So stimulating monoamines and maybe more importantly, activating a circuit. Get it? Stimulating monoamines and activating a circuit. Something about the word circuit. Also, this is not FDA approved as a maintenance treatment. I don't really know why devices still are kind of treated differently. Most drugs, everybody just kind of assumes if it's working for you, you wouldn't stop, which is not always true, but you know that's usually kind of the way I think most people think. TMS is approved as an acute thing. The good news is that if it is successful, 2014 published data, about 2/3 of people are still fine after a year. And TMS can be repeated, and if it works well once, almost always works twice. Standard TMS protocol, this is kind of what hasn't changed in about 14 years, involves stimulating at frequencies of about 10 to 18 pulses per second, depending on which device you use, on the left dorsolateral prefrontal cortex in bursts. So there's a burst of pulses and a break, burst of pulses and a break. Treatment's usually about 20 minutes. The patients will hear clicking. The coil buckles against itself for the same reason why MRIs are so loud, because it's like a little mini MRI magnet in there. They usually do feel tapping on their head. That's because the magnetic field is inducing current in the scalp. So nothing's actually tapping the head. Does feel like the most annoying person in the world. It's flicking on the head. Usually attenuates after about a week. So we'll call that TMS classic. And then there are a couple new things. I was delighted to hear Dr. Singh allude to the Stanford protocol. And what kind of led to that was that theta burst, which is an interesting way to really shorten the treatment by kind of making the frequencies more complicated, led to the Stanford protocol, which means 10 theta burst treatments per day, right? About 9 minutes of treatment on the hour, every hour, for 10 hours, for 5 days. They got amazing efficacy, right? Some small studies, but they're boasting of these like incredible efficacy numbers. Because I am who I am, first words out of my mouth, are you sure people didn't just say they were better to get you to stop? It's like, you ready for day four? You know what, I'm good. And I'm really sorry I complained. It's like, let me go back to my life. So no, they got good efficacy and it seems to be well tolerated. And that protocol got FDA approved 30 seconds ago. So that protocol is now considered an FDA approved approach. Now, it is meant to be done with functional MRI guidance. It's going to require specialized equipment in order to be able to do that. And that equipment is supposed to be coming soon. Don't know when, so keep your eyes on that. One more new thing, there is a TMS coil called the H7 coil that was FDA approved for OCD. It stimulates in that dorsomedial kind of prefrontal cortex area, reaches all the way down to the anterior cingulate. 60 seconds ago, that got FDA approved for depression. So for the first time in TMS history, I got two different coils that do two completely different things that are both FDA approved to treat depression. And I'll be darned if there isn't some suggestion that you can stratify depression by different kinds of symptom sets to maybe hedge your bets by picking one coil over the other. So again, I was delighted to hear Dr. Singh discussing biotypes, because this maybe is going to be one of the first clinical examples that I can use in the clinic to pick treatments for people based on subtypes of depression. So things are getting exciting. And now, may I have permission to rant for at least 60 seconds? Thank you. Algorithmic care. Show of hands, who in the room is at least familiar with the University of Texas algorithm for the treatment of depression? Okay, this is the NEI crowd, so I expected like not zero. So I am excited about that. I had this beat into my head in residency. So here's my rant when we're talking about treatment-resistant depression. If we're gonna do four medication trials, should that take 2 years? No, right? An appropriate trial, 6 to 8 weeks, maybe a little bit longer. So when we're looking at a picture like this with an algorithm, what I am dying to see, what I'm dying to see with good aggressive care, is one SSRI, right, following the Texas algorithm, 4 to 8 weeks at most. If it doesn't make a dent, we switch. If it makes a small dent, think about increasing the dose or augment. Move on to another drug, move on to another drug. After no more than about 3 or 4 drugs, we should be thinking about novel things, right? NMDA, esketamine, move into it quickly. I think it's important to get people in remission because, well, remission, that's awesome, but getting them into it quickly is probably an even better plan. Other novel things upcoming, now dextromethorphan, bupropion's already approved, right? And that happened like while this slide was being written. So you have that available to you. Other ways to potentiate dextromethorphan are being looked at for depression. We got dextromethadone, esmethadone, hallucinogens, MDMA, psilocybin, breakthrough status, right? Remember when Dr. Cutler discussed that? GABA A PAMs, anti-diabetic drugs for depression? Like, is there nothing that semaglutide can't do, apparently? There was one tiny little study where GLP-1 agonist directly induced some anxiety behavior in rats, but at the same time lowered depressive behavior. And I just can't get out of my head the image of a bunch of rats filling out PHQ-9s. They're like, wow, getting better. So it does have a direct effect. Does it also have something to do with insulin resistance? Did I say you should keep your eyes on metabolics? And anti-inflammatories and immune modulators are also going to be really, really important in the future. So in summary, need a breath. Depression is multifactorial and complex with many contributing factors. Only about a third are getting remission on that first try. And what that means to me is we gotta move to all the other tries as fast as we can so that we can get that remission, because people need to be in remission because it's possible. So we should settle for nothing less. Challenges are residual symptoms by definition. You're not gonna catch them if you don't screen, right? Screen. Medication side effects, of course, because people don't always wanna take the pills. And sometimes it takes time, but we might be able to make that a little bit better now that we have some novel agents that can sort of get us to the home plate a little bit faster. And then there are plenty of evidence-based non-pharmacological treatments that could be effective, kind of both as a treatment-resistant depression treatment as well as an augmentation strategy. And they're becoming available and covered by insurance and just really not that hard to get. So think about those things early.